Shiny Goons.
Hello and welcome everyone to the show that gets people talking about something else. This is Big Shiny Goons and it is episode, I should probably check the number before we start, it's 32. And kind of season two, because we're rejuvenating the pod today. I'm your host, Thomas, and with me today is Philadelphia Flyers beat writer for The Athletic, Charlie O'Connor. Charlie, how's it going, man?
Hey, it's going pretty well. It's really cool to be on the show.
Yeah, no problem. Any opportunity to talk about music, you know, just you want to get to it, right?
I do a lot of it on Twitter already, so I figure a podcast is a nice second way to do it.
Yeah, it's I feel like, I guess we'll just get straight to it off the top, because I saw a tweet recently. I forget what album it was from the review of, but it was talking about a band that, like, and in the review it said, oh, everyone that writes about sports likes this band, like, along with Pup, along with I forget the other bands that are on it, but, like, why do you think that is? Like, just certain bands every sports writer just, like, goes towards.
It's a really good question. I think, like, the original is probably Bruce Springsteen, particularly from, like, the old heads. Yeah. Like, any male sports writer who's over the age of, like, 45 is obsessed with Bruce Springsteen. I don't know. Maybe it's, like, a personality thing. But, yeah, it was in a 10-year retrospective article that was released today on Japan Droid Celebration Rock. Mm. And it was Ian Cohen, who's one of my favorite music writers. He freelances, but he does a lot for Stereo Gum, which is where this piece ran. And he was naming, like, the Menzingers, Pup, Spanish Love Songs, Pew Pew Pew, all of whom I really like. And then when I read that, tend to be popular among people who write about sports, really, it was like, man, I feel seen.
Yeah, it's people just, like, go towards, I guess it might be, like, a background thing, like, oh, it's normally people that grew up watching sports all the time and, like, really just fell in love with it, play sports, but it's still, like, you're not playing anymore or as much. So it's the, like, you've grown out of it a little bit. So it's, like, the standard kind of trajectory and you fall in line with those bands. Like, even along, like, it might be the softer side, but, like, Phoebe Bridgers, like, that whole Boy Genius, like, it felt like everyone was falling in love with them. And then if you followed any sports writers, it'd be talking about that, especially at The Athletic as well. Maybe it's just the younger side, but it's just a fun phenomenon.
It is. I think there's an element, you know, particularly with bands like these. Phoebe Bridgers maybe doesn't quite fit this this realm, but she's just a really good songwriter. But bands like these, I think it kind of fits a sweet spot because they're definitely more on the rock side, so it fits with that, like, you know, we grew up watching sports, so you have that, like, jock inclination, even if we weren't jocks. But there is that element of, like, yeah, we're gonna, like, dudes rock, that whole thing. But then also they're, like, singing about their feelings and about how things are bad, and I think that appeals to, like, the creative writer side of, like, us as sports writers. So it just kind of hits that sweet spot where it's like, we're gonna rock, but you're also gonna think about stuff.
Yeah, definitely. And, like, I know, so we'll get to the album that you talked about, or you're gonna talk about later, but one of the albums that you mentioned, and I've already talked about on here with Sean Woodley, a Raptors reporter, was Titus Andronicus, The Monitor. And Titus Andronicus, I feel like, is another band where it's very, like, poetic. You get your, like, English literature textbook out and your, like, history book.
Oh, yeah.
And then you talk about that. And so, like, it's kind of the nerd side of it also. Like, it's just the different characteristics of, like, oh, if you're more of a, like, getting into hockey history or, like, sports history and you're like that, or, like, if you're on the number side, not to be super, like, punny, but, like, math rock, like, or something like that, like you're really into American football or something, like, as your emo whatever side. But it's really interesting to think about, and I feel like I'm glad that people are more straying out of that path of Bruce Springsteen or anything.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been a big Bruce guy, but I like a lot of the bands that, like, very clearly take a lot of cues from Bruce Springsteen. Like, Titus Andronicus definitely takes a lot of cues from Bruce Springsteen. Yeah. And I love The Monitor, it's not what we're going to be talking about today because you've already done it on one of the shows, but I mean, that's probably my favorite album of the 2010s. And I went to the, they did a 10-year anniversary show of it. Like, it was like two or three years late because of the pandemic. That was in like late Q4 of last year. And it was an incredible show. And, you know, that's an album where, I mean, they're singing about like, you know, going to Fenway Park and going to minor league baseball games while also comparing everything to the Civil War. And as a history major, I can certainly appreciate that.
There you go. Yeah, that's perfect. What else are we going to talk about? And like, I feel like up here, maybe it's a little bit different in Canada, but it's the Tragically Hip up here for instead of Bruce Springsteen. So it's that whole kind of genre, but then you're getting more into it. And I've talked about this article a lot, but Sunaya Suppurgi on The Athletic a couple of years ago, or a few, might be actually longer than that, talked about the relation between hockey and hardcore, and just like, and talked to Stephen Babcock of Pup and Propagandhi guys and the original Slapshot band, so the hardcore band from Boston. And yeah, it was really interesting. Like I recommend it to anyone. It's more like the hardcore stuff, but it's interesting. There's the relationship between sports and music is just crazy. I guess that's what this whole podcast is about. But anyways, we'll talk about a little bit on what you've had to go through this season. Unfortunately, as someone that covers the Philadelphia Flyers for a living, have you had a chance to kind of breathe a little bit after the hurried months and several months of watching terrible hockey?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's been nice the last few weeks to be able to turn my brain off a little bit and just not have to analyze and watch truly horrid hockey. It's, you know, it's a job and I still love it, but it can get exhausting, you know, just because it gets really difficult to write stories about a bad team that's going nowhere, because how many times can you really write the same, this is pathetic, they keep doing the same things over and over again and making the exact same mistakes over and over again. And, you know, I personally, not that I can't do, you know, featurey stories, but I enjoy doing analysis more. You know, that's kind of where I came up, you know, coming up as a blogger and doing more analytically focused pieces. And when a team's bad, understandably, there isn't a lot of appetite beyond like you explaining why they're bad. But once you've done that, you can't do that every week, because the reasons why they're bad are going to stay the reasons why they're bad. And then people want to read other stuff, which usually is either like, if they're optimistic people, it's like, I want to read about, you know, like featurey things about players or coaches or whatever. And if they're very angry people, they just want to read about you screaming that everyone should be fired or traded.
Yeah. And well, even especially with the Flyers, like it feels like a lame duck situation almost, where it's like everything is up in the air. Like there's no real sense of like stability in places, where it feels like if you're writing something, be like, well, this could all change in a month, I don't know, like especially or even retrospective stuff about the season and like talking about players going into the summer, it's like, well, who knows what's going to happen. But it's interesting. How has not regarding a bad team or anything, but like how do you deal with like, I guess, going through the rhythms of like covering a seat for a season?
You know, I think the way that tends to work is that there are your touch points over the course of a year that kind of keep you focused. Like, you know, you've got the trade deadline, you've got the draft, you've got, you know, free agency, you've got the start of the season, you got training camp. So a lot of it, you know, you have them maybe, you know, during kind of the, you know, after the first couple of weeks of the season through like the season's midpoint, then you hit, you know, the holidays and that's a little bit different. And then you can position the thing. So a lot of it, you just kind of fall into rhythm, but you're always looking at like the next big thing, what's going to be the next part of the season that gets people talking. And I think that's a lot of the way that I tend to keep myself on track, because I know what's coming down the pike. And obviously for the Flyers, I mean, for a good 2 months, most of the talk was about the trade deadline, specifically about whether Claude Giroux was going to get traded. So, you know, that dominates the discussion in a way that the games even don't anymore, because obviously the team wasn't playing well. So it's not like the games actually mattered too much from a playoff, you know, standpoint. So it ended up just being a lot of people talking about who was going to get traded. Was Drew going to get traded? If he was going to get traded, who was he going to get traded to? So that to me is more how I kind of stay in a rhythm, is like, what's going to be the next big event, and then trying to figure out ways to cover that as best as you can.
Yeah. And I guess speaking of Drew, will it be weird, and barring anything, any crazy decision, obviously he'll be a free agent. But how will it be weird kind of not covering him and not watching a team for 82 games that doesn't feature him?
I mean, it was weird covering the team after he got traded. Just him not being there, because he's always been there. You know, from the moment I started covering the Flyers, even just as a blogger, that was, you know, like late 2011 is when I started writing about the team and started being able to go to games. He's always been there, and he's not just always been there. He's been arguably the team's best player for pretty much that entire run. So it was weird. It was really weird watching games without, you know, 28 flying around in orange and black. And especially for me, because, you know, before I was a writer, I mean, I'm from Philadelphia. I was a Flyers fan. You know, that's all I was. And I remember when he got drafted, I kind of decided that he was going to be like my favorite player. You know, I basically didn't really have one at the time. And I watched, you know, his highlight reel from the Olympics and in the queue, and just loved it. It was like, this guy's going to be really good. And then, so when he got called up, I have a jersey of his from like before he even had an A, let alone a C. And it was weird. You know, you have that, like that fan relationship, and then you sort of have to turn it off and then cover the guy, you know, as a journalist. So there was always an element of weirdness there with me with trying to cover Giroux that maybe didn't exist for other players. So I didn't have that, because I mean, basically the entire team had been turned over. It's basically just Giroux. You know, he was the only guy left from, you know, those late 2000s or early 2010s teams, you know, at least in terms of guy being a serious impact on those teams. I guess JVR was there too, but he left for a while, so he's a little bit different. Giroux was kind of my last tether to that era when I was just a fan. So it was weird. It was weird having him, you know, leave, because now that final tether is gone. And now like I'm real a journalist.
Yeah. So I guess when you decided like Giroux was your guy, were you in at a point of fandom where you're trying to really find, like, I guess you said like a tether, like, were you trying to find that tether, or were you just like deciding on a player, you're just like, this is the guy right now? I'm a huge fan, but like, I really want to just connect with one player.
Yeah. I mean, I had like, so I really liked Simone Gagné, but he had been dealing with like injury problems and stuff. And it looked like really sure like what direction his career was necessarily going to go. So it was like, okay, I need to, you know, it not even need to, it just kind of, cause it happened organically. It certainly wasn't like, I need to find a new favorite player. It was more like they drafted Drew. I started watching tape and it was like, okay, this guy's going to be my next favorite player. Like I could just tell, because he plays a style that I find, you know, really, really fun to watch. And I think he's going to be really good, even though there's people who are skeptical of it. And then when he turned out to be really good, it was just like this big old pat on the back. Like, see, I was right. Which then, you know, makes you even like the guy even more, because it makes you feel like, oh yeah, he made me look smart. So yeah. That's sort of where it stemmed from. But no, I mean, I wouldn't say that I was like, I need to have a favorite player, because I, as I said, I did really like Simone Gagné at the time. He was probably my favorite player during that era before Giroux. But even after, because there was a couple years where the two overlapped, and I was still like, once Giroux came up and established himself as an NHL player, like he was my favorite player on the team. Gagné was still up there, still really liked him as well, but Drew was the guy. And as I said, then it got real weird when you have to interview him.
Yeah. Just wearing a Drew jersey, just like, oh sorry, just
ignore. Yeah, right. This. Like,
oh man. Anyways, yeah, let's get talking to some music, about some music. I'm still obviously the first episode back in a while, so I'm still a little bit rusty with these transitions. But yeah, so I guess what, Charlie, could you tell the lovely audience what you're listening to lately?
Sure, sure. So I think like probably my band of this year, not that I didn't like them before. I really, really liked their last album, but it came out 5 years ago at this point. Gang of Youth has just been my band of this year. I love their new album, Angel in Real Time. I just saw them in like 2 weeks ago. I saw them two nights in a row in concert because they played in Philadelphia. There was a technical issue and they had to only do an acoustic show because one of their like tech people basically got electrocuted during sound check. So the venue couldn't use electricity. It was wild. And the acoustic show was really good, but I had heard that their live show is fantastic, full band. So on a whim, I bought a ticket to their show the next night down in DC and drove down there. And it was incredible. I mean, they're really just like basically an alternative rock band. Mm-hmm. They're based out of Australia. They're huge over there. They really haven't broken here, but they're very much like they want to be the biggest band in the world. And they have that sound where it's just, you know, they're trying to like fill up arenas. And it just makes for this like really life-affirming sound. Like the new album, this is the kind of stuff that they like write about. Like their new album is the story of the album is it's about his father. It's about the lead singer's father. Mm-hmm. But basically when his father was on his deathbed, his father essentially said to David, the lead singer, like, I have some secrets. You might want to do some digging. And he started doing some digging and basically found out that like his father A was 10 years older than he said he was, B had two kids that he just like left and like didn't see for their entire lives, and also had lied about his race. Like he said he was half white and actually he wasn't. So the whole album is basically a concept album about the lead singer like trying to come to terms with the fact that like his father lied to him and his sister about his origins and everything, but like also reconciling that with the fact that obviously he still loves his father and mm-hmm. you know, all the things that his father did for him. And it's just like one of those fascinating concept albums that, you know, the songs are great, but it also, you know, is I'm a big like cohesive album person and it definitely works on that level. So they're like my band of this year. I've also really, really liked the new Porridge Radio album that came out last week. That's been like the album that I've been spinning a lot this week because they're like a UK post-punk band, but this is basically an emo album, which like kind of gives me vibes of like Cursive because like it's like an indie rock album, but like it has the soul of an emo album.
Right.
And like kind of, like, I don't know if you've ever heard The Meadowlands by the Wrens, but it kind of reminds me of that as well, where like the lyrics are extremely, you know, like for lack of a better word, emo. Like it's very like pouring your guts out, but like the songs sound like something that would get like a, you know, 9.0 on Pitchfork. But I love it. That's an album. I like their last album that came out in 2020, Every mm-hmm. Bad, but this one is, to me, it's like a massive step forward. So that'll probably be in my top two or three at the end of the year.
That's perfect. Yeah. I've listened to Every Bad from Portrait and remind me, maybe just because I was listening to it or revisiting it at that time, but like Hop Along, like it was yeah. kind of similar where like the music is more like upbeat, I guess, like just alternative rock, and Hop Along is like they kind of stray the more a little bit post-punk, yeah, like you're saying. But then the lyrics are like incredibly like self, like inner thoughts, self-reflective about like, oh, what am I thinking, what at this time, like, oh, someone left me, what, like you're speaking to someone for some songs, or you're yeah, like alone and just thinking by yourself. But yeah, I really liked Every Bad, so I should check that album out. With Gang of Youth, so like, so you said musically it was like an arena rock band, like, so they sound like it was, I haven't listened to them, and my first inclination with like Australian bands would be like Tropical Fuckstorm or something like that. so maybe it's a little bit different, but yeah, like, so it's just like a very big kind of like arena rock band. Like the first band that I think of arena rock is like Muse or something like that, but like a little bit more punky, or like
I wouldn't compare them to Muse.
No,
yeah. I mean, I feel like Muse is kind of their own own animal, for better or worse. So the album that got me into them, which I believe was released in 2017, Go Farther in Lightness, that was very it's actually the band we're going to be talking about. If you, they're heavy national cues, Gaslight Anthem, definitely you can hear it, like Frank Turner. There's an obvious respect for Bruce Springsteen in there as well. But it's kind of that, like, you know, like just real widescreen, like almost like kind of the sound like that the Killers have been going for over the last few albums, like that sort of arena rock type vibe. So not, you know, like proggy, but definitely more, you know, like heartland type rock. This album's a little bit different. It still has those vibes because, like, he has a deep voice and whatnot, but it's a little bit more almost like U2-ish, in the sense that it's just even more widescreen. There's more like electronic flourishes and like chants and stuff. But I definitely wouldn't put them in the Muse bucket. Like Gaslight, I think, is Gaslight Anthem, I think, is a band that they get compared to a lot, but just even bigger. Like basically like take like the 59 sound and ramp that up to 1,000 right. And that's you're getting close to what they are. But yeah, I mean, they're one of those bands. I tend to have a feeling with the kind of music I listen to. And like, I act like this on Twitter because I feel like I'm just shouting into the void and like, hey, if you want to listen to my music recs, that's great. If not, I don't care. But like, if I'm talking to people that I actually know, I tend to hesitate to recommend bands because I'm afraid they're not going to like them.
Yeah.
Because my thing is, you know, my taste is a little weird. So I don't want to like recommend people bands that I think they're not going to like. Like if I recommend a song or an artist to a friend, like I really think they're going to like them, and I don't do it all that often, not because I don't want my friends to like my music, but because I just don't think they will a lot of times. But Gang of Youths is one of those bands that I'll pretty much recommend them to anyone if they're just into rock music in general. Like, obviously I'm not going to recommend them to somebody who like exclusively listens to hardcore punk or something, like somebody who's like very clearly in one, you know, has a very small avenue of music they tend to like. But if you're just like a general rock fan, I pretty much would recommend Gang of Youths to anyone because I think they're easily accessible, but there's also a lot going on below the surface.
Oh yeah, that's great. I do notice, so you're speaking of like tweeting album or recommendations or anything like that. You always put out, I think the last couple of years at least, the like albums of the year kind of you're forming through it. Like, is that something you keep in track of like throughout the year? And you mentioned it, I guess, the Gang of Youths album, just keeping that up or the Porch Radio. But yeah, like, is that something you always just keep in mind? Just, oh, that's like a fun little side project.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I use like Rate Your Music, which is a website, like they essentially just like where people can like rate music. But they let you create like lists of albums if you want. Mm-hmm. And I use that to kind of just keep track of like which ones I still need to listen to, which ones, you know, are probably going to be on like my short list and whatever. And then like, I just listen to them over and over again because they're my favorite albums of the year. And then at the end of each year, I do like to do like write-ups of the albums that really hit me hard. You know, it's just for my personal blog. Like, I don't make any money off of it, but I enjoy writing about music. I don't act like I think I'm like really good at it, but I just enjoy having somewhere to put my thoughts down. And because in a way, like, you know, for me, I mean, I'm a big lyrics person. I'm not a musician. I guess it's probably in part because I'm a writer. Like, lyrics really, really hit me. So the albums that I tend to like over the course of a year, like the albums that I really like, the ones that end up in my top five or top 10, like they, in a lot of ways, are my favorite albums of that year because of the way that my year played out, you know, the emotions that I felt, the events that happened and whatnot. And in a way, like writing about those albums at the end of the year, it kind of feels like I'm tying a bow on my entire year. Because like, I mean, I'm obviously not going to, you know, go into excruciating detail about every single way I relate to all my favorite albums, but it's a way to sort of, you know, put down on paper or online, whatever, you know, kind of what this year meant to me in music form. And it's cathartic in a way. And I mean, I enjoy writing about sports, but it's a job. You know, it becomes different when you're writing about hockey for work, because then it's work. Even if you enjoy it, it's still work. Whereas with music, I can write about music and just purely do it for my own enjoyment and my own, you know, kind of emotional release.
Yeah, definitely. I found that. So I've written for this one, I started a very long time ago, but and I haven't for a while. But is a music blog up here called Dominionated. So they focus solely on Canadian music. but really kind of getting into that, I guess, like albums and artists that people, like the main publishers and even main blogs up here aren't really covering. So like any publishers like Now or Exclaim or anything like that aren't really talking about. So it gets into this like weird avant-garde space sometimes, and like you're listening to this like atmospheric spatial like solo cello album or something. But that's sometimes, but I found like writing about music is a lot, it's just like a full exercise sometimes, where you get to really flex your, I guess, creative writing muscles of not, and sometimes that could leak into hockey and more casual blogging and talking, if you really want to be like like write about this like a hockey fight, but in such like with such imagery, and like that you're talking about the raindrops of blood on the ice or something like that. But but like with music, it's like you're forced to do that almost, like, because what else are you going to say? Like, are you going to talk about like the, oh, this like certain pitch sounded really cool, or like this certain chord progression, and then like it'll go over people's heads unless they're a musician. But and that's a whole other blog for that. But you get to really talk about like, what does this inspire in you? What does this like bring out of you? Like, I remember I was talking about this one like trio, kind of like punk band that was in Victoria. And I was like, I could imagine like them playing the soundtrack of like this very specific like 90s skate video. Like, it's very like, okay, what does this talk about? Like the whole environment of it. So yeah. And I found it's just really fascinating, just really like a good, almost like a, just to keep you well oiled in your, like to keep that interest in writing, just other than have that kind of weighing you down of you're repeating the same things over and over again. But yeah, it's great. I did my first list last year of just like albums that I liked and didn't list them, but it's a good little thing to just keep thinking about, like, oh, what am I like favorite? And it's kind of a, you get to look back and see what you really liked, and it's just kind of where you're at when this album was released or anything. Are you someone that like has to, not necessarily has to, but generally listens to an album right when it's released?
I would say yeah. Mm-hmm. I would say the only caveat, and this is, I think I've tweeted about this, but like it's a very weird aspect of me as a music listener, is that it's probably not even me as a music listener, it's probably just me as a person. Like, I have that like very like, you know, I have a to-do list and I have to get through my to-do list. So when I fall behind my like album listening, like if I, let's say like, you know, this happens a lot during the season, you know, there'll be months where I just don't have the time to listen to the albums I want to listen to. I tell myself that like, I'm not going to like let myself listen to new newly released albums until I catch up on the ones that I want to listen to from earlier on year, which is like legitimately kind of neurotic and insane. But it's just sort of the way I do it. So like usually when the season gets finished, I spend like the next couple of weeks just like plowing through a bunch of albums and just trying to catch up. And like, I'm fully caught up now, which is why like the Porridge Radio album came out on Friday last week and I was able to listen to it immediately. But it's just one of those weird things. So I would say in general, yeah, I really do love the act of like, especially if you're really excited for an album, like I love the idea of staying up until midnight and then it hits the streaming services and you can listen to it immediately. That sense of anticipation, it's just to me, it's very pure. It's just pure music fandom, and I love that. So I love being able to participate in that. Like I remember, and it's funny, like I had never really been a huge Taylor Swift fan. But you know, we're in quarantine, and you know, again, it goes back to the band we're going to talk about. Like, there was the surprise release of Folklore, and then it gets like, oh well, she's working with Aaron Dessner from The National, who is one of my favorite bands. So I'm like, yeah, like I'll get all in on this. Like, what else am I doing? I'm locked in my house. Like, sure, I'll listen to the Taylor Swift album, and then like I really liked it, but I remember it being like 12:20 on that Friday. And being like four songs in, and I tweet it like, holy crap, I really like this album. I did not see this coming. And it's like, that's the cool part about music. Like, I will always, if there's an artist or a band that like I've always respected because I think that they have artistic merit, but I just never been able to get into them. Like I will always give their new work a shot because I want it to click for me. And sometimes it never does. Like sometimes like Big Thief is a band. Every time they release an album, I give it a shot. And every time it doesn't click for me. And maybe one day it will, but it hasn't yet. But then there's bands like Vampire Weekend where like they didn't click for me for years. And then I listen to Modern Vampires of the City, and it's one of my favorite indie rock albums of the 2010s. And like, if I would have just given up on them, I never would have had that album hit me as hard as it did, because I would have just assumed I'm not a Vampire Weekend fan. And kind of the same thing with Taylor Swift. Like Folklore was one of my top five albums of 2020. And that album honestly like hits me pretty hard, and never would have expected the Taylor Swift album would hit me really hard. But I was like, yeah, I'll give it a shot. Why not? It's a cool story. And could be something I could enjoy, and it ended up I did.
Yeah. Yeah. The pandemic listening was a true thing. Of I even remember, I think that's basically how I listened to the Punisher. And it was like the first, think I was on holiday actually, because I think it was in June. It was released like June 2020, I want to say. And I was on holiday, and then we just decided like it released, and we're like, okay, we'll stay up and listen to this. And it was the first like in a while listening experience of like, yeah, I'm just like listening to this track by track, fully like attentive almost, and not just like commuting and just like, oh, I'll check this album out or something. It's that was the, I guess, the one benefit of you're being able to have time, and you're like, yeah, I could take an hour just by myself, it's cool. So speaking of, I guess, first listens and talking about albums and I guess what we're doing on this podcast, let's just get right to it. Let's talk about the album while you're here. So Charlie, could you tell the audience what album you want to talk about?
Sure. So this album is, I've already said it a couple of times, yeah, by a band called The National. They're more or less based out of Brooklyn, but they're from like Ohio. So there's that's, I think that's actually an element that comes through in their music, that push pull of like Midwesterners, you know, going to a big city kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But the band is the album is Alligator, which came out in 2005. It's probably, I guess, their breakout album. Like Boxer is their biggest, but they had released two albums before Alligator, their self-titled debut, which isn't that good. And then an album called Sad Songs for Dirty Lovers, which actually is quite good. But that would, they were still very, very much underground. And Alligator, when it came out, it didn't get much fanfare. Like one of the famous stories is that they toured with Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, who was a hype band in the mid 2000s, like Pitchfork, basically like gave their self-released album like a 9. This was at the height of when Pitchfork was like the tastemakers. Right. And the tour with The National had already started, and The National was the headliner, and Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah was the opener. And then the review comes out, and then Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah suddenly becomes this, you know, this phenomenon in the indie world. And people were going to the show, staying for Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, and then leaving. So like they were the headliner playing to like half filled venues because everyone was just there for Clap Your Hands because they had this great Pitchfork review. And it took some time for this album, I think, to kind of build momentum. But over the course of 2005, I think it just slowly did. And they slowly started to get more and more hype and more fans. And by the time Boxer came out, which was probably their biggest, that or High Violet, I think like the music world was kind of primed to love it because Alligator had kind of like, it had turned so many people slowly but surely into fans of the band that everyone was really excited to see what they were going to do next. But you don't get to Boxer without Alligator, because Alligator was the album that sort of set the stage for their big breakout. But the Alligator, I think, was the first album that got them, you know, legitimate attention in the indie world and the rock world at large.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think I became more aware of them. I think it was their Boxer release, like that was 2007. So that kind of makes sense. Yeah. And there's the tie with, I think, the Obama campaign. Whole tie with it. I think that's what I'm remembering. But yeah, it's a crazy kind of how, I guess, just like big picture, The National have been able to stay as kind of like an under the radar band and never get, I feel like, the huge wide, or from what my perspective is, the like burst into this onto the scene, like they always have some sort of genuine, I want to say, like some aspect to them that they don't seem that they're like breaking into the pop world or anything like that. Like even with the folklore connection with Aaron Dessner, it's like it's still, they're still seeing this like, I want to say coolness for the lack of a better term, but it's the hip, the like still under the radar kind of attribute of them that if you listen to them, you're still able to kind of connect in this different way of you're part of national fans, where I feel like other bands, like even like Wilco or something like that, kind of in the same era, same kind of, I feel like general, same fandom, kind of had that kind of burst into the popular scene. But anyways, like with Alligator, what was your, I guess your first listen? Like, do you remember the first time you listened to Alligator?
I think so. I don't know if I can talk about the very first listen. I could definitely talk about my initial impression. So I found Alligator like in the beginning of 2006. So it came out in 2005. Mm-hmm. I remember being on a blog. It probably doesn't even exist anymore, but it was like going through the like their opinion of the top 20 American rock bands. I believe The Hold Steady was number one on that list. Yeah. And I think that's how I got into them as well. But number two was The National, who I never heard of, like legitimately never heard of. And the description was interesting to me. And at the time, like this is 2005. So at the time I was very much just like an emo punk kid. I mean, that was my world. Like I was, you know, going to emo shows and, you know, like Thursday, like all those bands, that was my world. But I was like slowly kind of opening myself up to indie rock. Like the album that really opened me up to indie rock was, and you'll notice by the trail, Dead Source Tags and Codes, in part because that's like a very much a rock album. Mm-hmm. But also like definitely has, you know, the complexities that indie rock fans tend to gravitate towards. Like then I got into Death Cab via Transatlanticism. So I was sort of like priming myself for indie rock. So I was like, okay, let me try to like find some other bands in that mold. And I stumble across The National. So I downloaded Alligator and I didn't really like it at first. The one song that stuck with me on first listen was Looking for Astronauts. I love that song. And ironically, it's probably one of my least favorite songs on the record now. But I'll always have that like connection with it because it's like the first song of theirs I really liked. And I remember I used to listen to music on Windows Media Player, you know, in my room. And I used to like they had like the little like 5-star thing that you could rate every song.
Yeah.
And like for the longest time, like Looking for Astronauts was the only song that was 5 stars, and like Secret Meeting, which is the opener, I think I had as like a 1-star, and like Lit Up was like a 4. And there was like a few songs I kind of liked, like the screaming songs I liked more, but I wasn't super into them. But for whatever reason, and I think this is one of the appeals of The National, particularly during this era, it just kept like, I kept coming back to it, even though I didn't like love it at first. It was just an album that for whatever reason, like if I would be just chilling, you know, like having like an AIM conversation or something, you know, on my computer, I'd put it on. And like, I put it on, I'd say to myself, like, I'm putting it on because I want to listen to like Looking for Astronauts. But I'd start it from the beginning and then just listen. And they would get to Looking for Astronauts. And then like the next song would go and I'd be like, oh, this is a slower song, but honestly, I kind of like it. And then probably by like the summer of 2006, like, they were becoming one of my favorite bands. And it was just one of those, like, I think a lot of people say that about The National, that they're kind of a slow burn. And part of that, I think it speaks to what you were saying earlier, which is the fact that, you know, they never really, well, they got big. They certainly mm-hmm. got big on like the festival circuit. You know, they could headline things. Like I remember I saw them as one of the top bands at Made in America here in Philadelphia, the festival that the Jay-Z curates. So they got big, but there's an element of them where like, they're not singing about happy stuff. Like this is not like a poppy band. I mean, they're singing about really, really difficult, you know, like emotions that you have to work through and, you know, like hiding your, I think one of the themes that I come back to a lot listening to Alligator in particular, I think it's probably the album they nailed it the best, is just this feeling of like hiding your emotions. Like the first song is Secret Meeting, and like the key line is just, I had a secret meeting in the basement of my brain. And it's just a lot of Alligator to me, and a lot of their stuff in general, but Alligator, as I said, in particular, is just very much about this idea of like hold it together and like kind of like don't let anyone else like see you suffer kind of thing. And like, I feel like those are the kind of emotions, if you're conveying them in your lyrics, where it doesn't really lend itself to, you know, like widespread fame, but it does lend itself to like, if you become a fan of them, you are so unbelievably connected with them because they speak to you on a level that like other bands don't even try to. And that's certainly the connection I feel with them. And I think that's the connection that a lot of their fans feel with them, which is why, you know, their fans are so devoted, I think even more so than most indie rock bands.
Yeah. And like, I feel like you don't put it on a national album to at a party necessarily.
No,
like,
no, that's,
like I feel like some indie rock bands, like even in the same area, like if you're thinking of like Arcade Fire, like you can feasibly like put it on a party. Your friends are, it's a collective experience of listening to this album. But I feel like maybe why their fans are so, I guess, headstrong about this band is that it's a very personal experience of listening to every album. Yes. That it's a, you are experiencing anything that they put out by yourself generally, or with a partner or with anything like that, that it's just something that's a different experience rather than enjoying yourself and having a couple beverages while listening to Neon Bible or something like that. But yeah, like it's, maybe it's that, maybe it's something else, but I feel like that is kind of a, it lends themselves to, I think, a different type of fandom.
I absolutely agree with that. Like, I think there was a, trying to think of the exact quote, but you know, here it is. It was from the guy, another band that I like, the Antlers. Mm-hmm. Yes. And this was back when High Violet came out. So this was in 2010, and like, he absolutely loves the National, or loved them. I don't know if he still does. I would assume he does. But his quote was that the National isn't so much a band as it's a piece of another person's life that helps yours make sense. And that quote always stuck with me because like, you can be, I think, a casual fan of the National. Like you can be like, oh yeah, Blood Buzz Ohio is a fun song, or like, I like Screaming Along to Mr. November or whatever. But if you're a real fan, like that's why you're a real fan. Mm-hmm. Because they hit you on a level that, I mean, that this is the kind of like interaction I love with music. I love when I have that kind of connection with lyrics and with a band. And the National, I think, are just one of the best at creating it, because they really like Matt Berninger, the lead singer and lyricist. I mean, he just pours himself into his songs. And I think that there's a subsection of music fans that really gravitate towards that. And I certainly would count myself as one.
Yeah, definitely. The first thing that I noticed about the National when I first discovered them was Berninger's voice, of just like being totally different. And a different characteristic that you don't see in a lot of bands, of just being, having such a baritone lead vocalist. Then also, as I was doing my, I guess, re-listening of this album, Alligator, what like clued me in was how it's differently mixed. I don't know. I would have to listen to other National albums to really see if it's a common thread, but like how, I guess, within itself, the vocals, and I'm going to get like super like music nerdy or whatever about this stuff, but like it's a different way of like conveying the, blending the vocals inside the instrumentals, where it's, other albums feel like very like you could almost hear how it's layered, or you have your vocal like floating on top or even below sometimes as a supporting act. But I feel like Alligator, all the way through, it's like right in the middle of the tone, where it's not necessarily, you might not be able to hear it at points because you're so distracted by it, like the piano or like keyboards coming in or something, or at times, but it just feels very like gelatinous. And that, there I go with like my imagery terms of like music writing, but like it just feels very like within that. And so like this little cube of just like mush, but in a good way, of like how this album is mixed. So it's a really interesting kind of listen.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really interesting way to put it. I never really thought of it that way, but I think you're right in that, and this might be part of the reason why it's an album that everybody, and this was something that was talked about a lot in reviews of Boxer, was that Alligator is a grower. It's an album that, like, I think in the Pitchfork review of Boxer, the writer who did that review basically said, like, we all learned how to listen to the National view via Alligator.
Right.
Like, we learned, like, you know, but part of that, I think, is that the vocals, while they're obviously the distinctive, the really distinctive part of the band, just because Matt has such a distinctive voice, like, they do kind of float, like, in and out. And because of that, like, there are lines, like, there were lines of songs on this album that I probably heard 100 times. And then on the 101st listen, it jumped out at me and then suddenly became my favorite line on the song. And that's not going to be the case necessarily if you're listening to an album that's mixed where the vocals are just right up front and center. Mm-hmm. And, like, every single syllable is, you know, like, the first thing you're thinking of, because in some of these songs, maybe during that part, you were focused on the drums. Like, the drumming to me on this album, and like, Brian Diefendorf has always been a great drummer. I think he's one of the best in indie rock. But, like, one thing I love in particular about Alligator, and it's unique, I think, to Alligator in their discography, is there are a few songs where the drums almost, like, they're almost too fast for the song. Like, if you listen to the drum in, like, Baby Will Be Fine, like, that drum beat is the drum beat you would think would be in, like, almost like a punk song. It's like a very propulsive drum beat. And then it's just, the song is just kind of floating along. Like, he's just, you know, doing his baritone thing, and you got some strings in there. And then, like, the Geese of Beverly Road is a very sparse song, but, like, the drum beat is insistent and it's pounding, even though it's a very slow and pensive song. And I think that, you know, in their later albums, like, you listen to, like, the drum beat in, like, you know, Mistaken for Strangers, and, like, that's a great drum beat. It shows how good of a drummer he is and that he can just nail it. But, like, that's a fast song. I love in Alligator some of the songs where they take these faster drum beats and they stick it in a song that isn't fast, and you just kind of have to, like, work through the disconnect, because it shouldn't sound like that, but it does, because they somehow make it work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Like, it pulls you in different ways, where it pulls your ear in different ways. And it's part of mixing, part of the kind of attribute of, I feel like, just there's a lot of thought put into every song on this album, that it's where sometimes you might just glide along where it's kind of all melds together. But I feel like there's a lot of just thought and process and determining what little every aspect of how someone will experience an album. And I think that just comes across, especially.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very much, and this is something I talk about in, you know, the articles I do about music, but I'm very much a person who thinks that, like track listing structure is really important to an album. And, you know, I my viewpoint is, like, I think an album should build momentum. You know, it should kind of be building to some sort of, like, cathartic release, usually, or like the 3/4 mark of the album. And then, you know, you have to then slowly build it back up to get to the final song, which is, you know, in a way, like, the final release, whether it's, you know, a slower song or a bigger song, you know, it has to be that summation of the album. And I think this album is so good at that. It just does such a good job. You know, Secret Meeting is kind of an anticlimactic opener, but it works so well at articulating, like, the lyrical themes that are going to keep popping up. Just, like, this feeling of isolation, this feeling of, you know, I kind of have to hide away to collect my thoughts. And there's also, it also presents one thing I absolutely love about the lyrics on this album, and this is something that I think, again, like, it really, it rewards repeated listens, is, like, Matt is not afraid to make jokes, and, like, it's all very, like, dark humor. Like, there's one part in Karen where, trying to think of the exact line, but he basically is just like, I feel he's basically just, like, complaining. And he's just like, I feel mechanical and thin. And then right after, he's just like, and hear me play my violin again. And it's just like that, like it almost, for someone coming out of the emo world, like this was a very good album, like for me, because it was like, it's an emotional album, but it's also extremely self-aware in a way that all most emo bands, maybe with the exception of like My Chemical Romance, like were not at the time. Mm-hmm. And there's an element with Matt where like he'll basically spill his guts and then right after make fun of himself for spilling his guts. And just like kind of like note the inherent absurdity of like thinking that your own emotions matter so much that you like should say them out loud. And like that's something that really speaks to me on a deep level. And I don't think many lyricists even try to get to that. But on this album, like he does it on multiple times where you're just like, you're about to wince and then you start laughing because he even notices and he recognizes how ridiculous he sounds in his, you know, his like emotional ruminations.
Yeah, it's like that relatability of like a normal person, a normal listener would feel weird just like even speaking their emotions to like a stranger or even like sometimes a friend as much as like if you're emotionally closed off or anything. But like just to have that like awareness, be like, yeah, I'm doing this like ridiculous. I'm feeling what you're feeling. I'm like, I know what, you know what this feels like. I'm not some like artist that can close their eyes and just like feel the music and be super like, try to act like that's a normal thing or anything like that, but yeah, it's definitely comes across that way.
Definitely. But yeah, I mean, this is just one of those records where, I mean, by the time I hit college, one thing that always cracks me up about The National and the way that they're portrayed, not that it's necessarily wrong, but the tag that they get given a lot is this idea that they're dad rock, and you hear that a lot, and like, I don't think it's unwarranted, especially when you get into like High Violet and their later albums, which like, cause I mean, like Matt's older, like he, you know, they, when Alligator broke, I think that he was in like his late 30s and that was, you know, mid 2000s. So like they're an older band. I mean, then that certainly starts to show in their later albums when like he's singing about being a parent and, you know, being a husband and stuff. So like very much they are dad rock now without a doubt, especially with what they're creating. But for me, I always laughed at it on two levels. Number one, because I mean, they were my favorite band in college. And I was like, okay, I mean, either I'm secretly a dad or this tag isn't actually right. Because like I'm an 18-year-old who's going to sleep every night listening to Boxer to, you know, to kind of like let me like take hold of my thoughts and get myself in a place where I can go to sleep. But also I will always say, like, Boxer, I can see why you would call that dad rock. I mean, a lot of it is that whole album, I think, at its core is about, you know, moving into a professional world and trying not to lose your soul in the process. And then like Trouble Will Find Me is very relationship driven. High Violet is dad rock on a lot of levels. And then like Sleep Well Beast is actually about being a dad. So like fair. But I've always viewed Alligator, I like when people will call them dad rock, I'm like, listen to Abel or listen to Mr. November and try to call them dad rock. Like that's like, I mean, those are garage rock anthems that end with like him screaming at the absolute top of his lungs. Like they're more emo songs than indie rock mm-hmm. songs, really, at their core, particularly Abel, like Abel and Lit Up especially. Like they have a song off Sad Songs for Dirty Lovers called Available. And it's just basically about like, you know, being really, really angry at like the person that, you know, like broke your heart. And it's like, yeah, it's basically an emo song. Like that's all it is. It's just sung by a guy with a baritone rather than, you know, a whiny 19-year-old. but I kind of forget where I was even going with this. But my point was that like, to me, Alligator to me, and you know, everyone's going to have their own interpretations of an album, but like Alligator to me will always be like you're lonely, drunk, and confused in your 20s. Like that to me is Alligator. And like the cover of the album, I think, speaks to it. Like it's just like a chandelier and then Matt like in like a dark room, but like it's very like it's like swirling. Mm-hmm. It's blurry, and it's almost like you get the sense that like he's drunk or at least buzzed. And it's just, to me, like Alligator always hit me as such a in your 20s album. And you're just like trying to figure stuff out and you're self-conscious, but you don't want to be. So you're kind of like always angry at yourself for that. but you're also frustrated with like the world in general. Like that to me has always been Alligator, which is why I find it weird when they get called Dad Rock. Cause it's like, okay, I get it on some level, but Alligator to me is like Alligator to me is almost like a flip side, like almost like the dark side of like the Strokes or like right. the Walkmen or something where it's like that. Those albums talk about like maybe like the glamorous side of like running around New York and partying in your 20s. Yeah. And Alligator is like the album you listen to like at 2 a.m. when you get back from the bars yeah. and you're just like sad and shit.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, exactly. And it might be even like the label of like just the, not to like say the vibe, but like also the vibe of the band, just like and who they hang around with and their tour and they're who they're getting reviewed by and just like I guess plainly I guess what they look like, but it's also like
yeah.
how much it goes by of like bands being labeled just by who they're associated with or what they're like the atmosphere comes off, not the music or like what their actual content is about, which could be interesting. But that's why I always say Alexis Morissette is new metal. But
hell yeah.
Yeah, there you go. But yeah, that it's perfect. I'm glad that you brought this album back and I was able to listen to it again, because I feel like it kind of rejuvenated my love of this band, because it was a very kind of fleeting moment and then I got into hardcore and in high school and did all that. But yeah, like it's I feel like it's just a very good band. Like if there was I usually ask the guests if there's one track that people would want to check out, but I do feel like this album is a very like complete album. It's nothing one that like you can't really get it from one song. Would you say that?
I would agree with that. I mean, yeah, it's so hard for me to say what my favorite song of this album is. Like, it's probably The Geese of Beverly Road, because that's probably mm-hmm. my favorite song by The National in general. But it's almost like, and this will get like very like nerdy from like a theme standpoint. But like, so The Geese of Beverly Road, one of the reasons why I love it so much is because like The National obviously is, you know, a pretty, you know, downbeat band. They don't sing about particularly happy things. The Geese of Beverly Road, I think, is one of their few truly happy songs. It's basically, I've always interpreted it as like, it's that like that drunken night that goes perfectly. Like it's, you know, it's the night where like you don't like you're happy buzz. You're just like running around the neighborhood, running around the world, just like, you know, feeling completely free. And it's just this pure moment. And it hits me. It's to me, it's like, it's almost like if a band is really good at expressing sad emotions, it almost adds even more power to the rare times they try to express happy emotions. And I think that's one of the reasons why that song hits me on such a deep level. But what I love about the way the album track listing works is that you have The Geese of Beverly Road, which is like, this is like the good side of going out and drinking and, you know, and being, you know, under the influence or whatever. And then they hit you with City Middle right after. And City Middle is one of the few, like the National song, like song structures tend to be pretty conventional. It's pretty like verse, chorus, verse. Mm-hmm. City Middle just kind of swirls around and around. And it's very much like, if you listen to the lyrics, it's very much like, in my mind, like Matt trying to like replicate being absolutely bombed and then getting home and being absolutely like devastated about something. And like, it doesn't actually make a lot of sense, but it's also utterly gorgeous. And I've always loved the dichotomy of like Geese of Beverly Road, City Middle, one right after the other, because it's like you have like this is the light side of this, and then this is the dark side of this. And the fact that City Middle comes after it, like, it kind of makes a point of like, you know, this maybe might not be the most healthy lifestyle in the world. Which I think, I'd like to think that maybe was the point they were trying to get at, where like, yeah, for, you know, for every Geese of Beverly Road night, you're going to have 10 City Middle nights. So like, you know, maybe don't like relish in the Geese of Beverly Road nights, but like, you know, maybe don't try to chase them too much, because you might end up, you know, pissing into a sink like they do in City Middle.
Perfect. Yeah, that's good. It's a good ending of the album. But yeah. And well, thank you so much for describing that album and talking about it. One thing that I'm going to do on this new, I guess, venture a new section of this podcast is I determined that if people are listening to this album, they are not album. If the people are listening to this podcast, people want to hear what I have to say about music as well, and not just the guests, because I'm thinking about that more. But yeah, so there's this one. I'm gonna do a little bit of a not recommendation, but just talk about an album that I've been really listening to a lot and checking out. So this week it is Military Guns, All Roads Lead to the Gun. I don't know if you know Military Gun, Charlie, but
I don't.
They're like a kind of, they're not, I don't even know if it's a side project, but so there's this power violence band of called Regional Justice Center, and their lead singer and drummer Ian Shelton basically also has Military Gun, who's he's just a singer of, but it's like the vocals are kind of hardcore-ish, but it's still very kind of post-hardcore instrumentals, maybe even going into the softer, like I guess indie punk, like not so much of like a technical or clean as Pup, but like still just very in your face kind of attribute of it. And last year they put out two EPs, All the Roads Lead to the Gun 1 and 2, and that first, I want to get the track right because I'm terrible with song names just because I listen to the album and then I stop. I believe it's No Flowers When You Die is the first track on the first version of it, and it's just like, it's basically their single or like their one song that they know, and it's just been, it's incredible. I love it, and it's just like has that very characteristic of their vocal style and having like almost guttural sounds at some points, like do like a ooh ooh kind of thing, but so it's like very kind of a 70s punk thing, but then also kind of goes into the modern style. So I'd recommend it, Military Gun. I know that they're touring right now, so they're it's a very, very good band. And I'm a sucker for album covers that are in black and white, so that's what drew me into them. But yeah, this so Military Gun, All Roads Lead to the Gun. Charlie, thank you so much for coming on the show. Is there anywhere people can find you and your stuff and your content and your writing?
Yeah. So as you said at the start of the show, I write for The Athletic. I cover the Flyers, you know, on a daily basis. You can find me on Twitter at CharlieO_Khan, where I, especially during the summer, I do tweet a lot about music. So even if you're not a Flyers fan, you could definitely see a lot of tweets over the next few months about me talking about albums and recommendations and songs and whatever. Also, I am on the Broad Street Hockey Radio podcast on our flagship show, which we record once a week. So you could check that out, you know, on all the podcast platforms, Spotify, Apple Music, all that. And then obviously at broadstreethockey.com, that's the website, and we post all the episodes on there. I'm obviously not the only one. I'm with, you know, three other great co-hosts and then a bunch of other people who do other shows as well. So definitely if you're interested in Flyers or just general hockey nonsense, that's a podcast I would highly recommend, and I'm not biased at all considering the fact that I'm on it. But yeah, those are the main places you can find me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great website. I'm not biased at all either.
No, not at all.
Well, thank you again, Charlie, for coming on, and yeah, have a listen. You can follow the podcast at big_shiny_goons, follow me at Sledge Williams, and rate and review, do all that good stuff, 'cause you already listened to this full podcast. So just do a 5 stars, you know that deal. And yeah, thanks once again, Charlie, for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.